Welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney in for Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, we'll get the latest on a tornado in Lowell. Brandon Smith will update us on the week that was at the State House. We remember U.S. Senator Burt Bie, and Sharon Jackson gets the scoop on Ravinia's 2019 lineup. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Former U.S. Senator Burt Bie, who championed the federal law banning discrimination against women in college admissions and sports, died at his home on Thursday at age 91. Bie was surrounded by his family at his home in Easton, Maryland, when he died shortly after midnight from pneumonia. Bie's son, Evan, followed him into Hoosier politics, becoming Indiana's governor and a senator. The liberal Bie had a back-slapping, humorous campaign style that helped him win three narrow elections to the Senate starting in 1962, at a time when Republicans won Indiana in four of the five presidential elections. Bie's hold on the seat ended with a loss to Dan Quayle during the 1980 Ronald Reagan-led Republican landslide. Bie was the lead sponsor of the landmark 1972 law prohibiting gender discrimination in education, known as Title IX, for its section in the Higher Education Act. The law's passage came at a time when women earned fewer than 10% of all medical and law degrees and fewer than 300,000 high school girls, 1 in 27, played sports. Bie said the law was aimed at giving women a better shot at higher-paying jobs. He continued speaking in support of Title IX's enforcement for years after leaving Congress. Burt Bie also used his position as head of the Senate's Constitutional Subcommittee to craft the 25th Amendment on presidential succession and the 26th Amendment setting the national voting age to 18. The issue of presidential succession was fresh when Congress approved the amendment in 1967. The vice presidency had been vacant for more than a year after President John F. Kennedy's assassination because there was no provision for filling the office between elections. The amendment led to the presidency of Gerald Ford less than a decade later, when Ford first succeeded Spiro Agnew as vice president and then took over the White House after President Richard Nixon resigned during the Watergate scandal. Bie's push to lower the national voting age from 21 to 18 came amid protests over the Vietnam War and objections that Americans dying on battlefields were unable to vote in all states. The amendment won ratification from the states in 1971. Bie was also a leading sponsor of the Equal Rights Amendment, which would have barred discrimination on the basis of gender. It passed Congress but failed to win approval from two-thirds of the states by its 1982 deadline. He had begun preparing to make a run for the 1972 Democratic presidential nomination when his first wife, Marvella, was diagnosed with breast cancer. He dropped that campaign but entered the 1976 presidential campaign, finishing second to Jimmy Carter in the opening Iowa caucuses, but then faring poorly later in the primaries. He's survived by his wife, Kitty, sons, Evan and Christopher, and four grandchildren. You're listening to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney, in for Dee Dotson. Following the death of Senator Burt Bie, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb has directed flags across Indiana to be flown at half-staff, said in a statement that flags should be lowered to half-staff from now until sunset on the day of Bie's funeral. The governor also asked Indiana businesses and residents to lower their flags to honor Bie, calling him, quote, a trailblazer who dedicated himself to improving the lives of all Hoosiers, end quote. Holcomb said Bie's, quote, remarkable legislative and personal legacy, end quote, had transformed the nation. He urged Hoosiers to keep Bie's family in their thoughts and prayers. You're listening to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney, in for Dee Dotson. The National Weather Service has confirmed the first tornado to strike Lake County since 2015. The Weather Service says an EF0 tornado with estimated peak winds of 80 to 85 miles an hour hit the outskirts of Lowell on Thursday afternoon, traveling about 1.5 miles over 2 minutes with an estimated maximum width of about 75 yards. The NWS says damage was limited to almost entirely just trees, including a large one that fell on a home. Storms also packing high winds and hail left thousands of power customers without service on Thursday across the state, though most had their power restored by Friday. The Weather Service recorded a 60-mile-an-hour wind gust at Indianapolis International Airport. It says damage from the storms included the roof being ripped off of a mobile home in the Indianapolis enclave of Speedway. You're listening to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney, in for Dee Dotson. A new study shows hate crimes laws often aren't utilized. House lawmakers change a school bus safety bill, and a Senate panel advances a bill to loosen restrictions on adoption advertising. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on The Week at the State House.
New research from Indiana University's Public Policy Institute suggests hate crimes laws aren't used as often as they could be. Researchers analyzed more than 300 bias-motivated homicides around the country, and hate crimes charges were filed in fewer than a third of those cases. House Speaker Brian Bosma says the data shouldn't impact this year's ongoing debate over hate crimes legislation. A measure meant to more harshly punish drivers who illegally pass school buses faced changes this week as a House committee advanced it. The bill would install cameras on school buses to catch passing motorists, an effort that came after a deadly incident in Rochester, Indiana last year. And the legislative panel added language that bars both schools and camera vendors from making profits off fines collected from enforcement of the increased penalties. And a Senate committee unanimously passed a bill that ensures people aren't committing a felony when they post online that they want to adopt a child. Current law only allows licensed adoption agencies and attorneys to advertise for adoption services. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney, in for Dee Dotson. Former U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly is joining a Washington, D.C. lobbying firm. Akin Gump announced Wednesday that the Democrat would be a partner in its public law and policy group starting next month. He will advise clients in the financial services, defense, and healthcare industries. Donnelly represented the South Bend area in the U.S. House for 6 years before winning election to the Senate in 2012. He lost his re-election bid to Republican Mike Braun in November. Donnelly cited Akin Gump's bipartisan team in a statement and said, quote, joining the firm was an easy decision, end quote. A spokesman for the firm says Donnelly will still teach classes at the University of Notre Dame and live in Indiana. Donnelly is leading 2 1-credit courses at the school this semester. You're listening to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney, in for Dee Dotson. A new report on obesity in Indiana was released on Thursday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports the state has the 12th worst obesity rate in the nation.
The number of people in Indiana who are obese or overweight continues to climb. New data shows that 1 in 3 Hoosiers are obese and more than 2 in 3 are overweight. The report comes from the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation. President and CEO Claire Fidian Green says researchers found the problem is driven by more than just genetics and behavior.
They point to changes in the environment where we live, work, and play that has really driven the increasing rates of obesity.
The report says obesity costs the state $8.5 billion annually in lost productivity and health care. It also outlines data about the effectiveness of strategies to fight obesity, like screenings and school exercise and nutrition programs. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney, in for Dee Dotson. Every 2 years, the state has to compile a list of its polluted rivers and streams and get it approved by the Environmental Protection Agency. But the EPA hasn't approved a list since 2013. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, environmentalists say that could delay cleanup for some of those waters.
The Environmental Law and Policy Center, the Alliance for the Great Lakes, and the Hoosier Environmental Council say they're giving the EPA 60 days to decide on the most recent list, or they'll file a lawsuit against the agency. According to a 2016 state report, more than 60% of Indiana's waters are unfit for human health and wildlife, mostly due to runoff from large animal farms. And in places like Northeast Indiana, that pollution doesn't just affect one state.
The nutrient pollution from the feces and sort of everything that comes from these farms flows directly into Lake Erie.
That's Alda Yuan, associate attorney with the ELPC. Once the EPA approves Indiana's impaired waters list, state and federal agencies can work to set pollution standards for those rivers and streams. We couldn't reach the EPA in time for comment. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney, in for Dee Dotson. Indiana's health systems are seeing a reduction in opioid prescriptions in response to the state's epidemic. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on one system's approach.
Indiana University Health took measures to address opioid overprescribing around the same time the state made moves. By integrating the state's prescription monitoring system with its own, IU Health tracks every opioid prescription and establishes guidelines. IU Health Chief Medical Executive Jonathan Gottlieb says this has allowed prescribers to reassess their practices.
I think Brandeis said sunlight is the best disinfectant. There's very little else we've needed to do so far other than showing the data.
New numbers show IU Health reduced prescriptions by 13% last year compared to 2017 and by 36% in emergency departments. There's no clear data to show that these reductions could lead to a decline in overdoses, which are still on the rise in Indiana, but experts say efforts can help prevent others from becoming addicted. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney, in for Dee Dotson. Spring is just around the corner, and soon, summer will be in the sights of Northwest Indiana residents. The seasons are changing, and one strong indicator is, of course, Ravinia announcing its upcoming schedule. Wells Kaufman, president and CEO of Ravinia Festival, spoke to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about the venue's 2019 lineup.
So it's great to talk to you once again, Wells. It's a great time for you. Tell us what's coming up in your upcoming season.
So many wonderful things. Over 75 debuts and premieres. We're continuing our extraordinarily successful celebration of the great American musician Leonard Bernstein. We've got Morrissey and T.I. coming for the first time. We've got Pentatonix and Sarah McLachlan coming back. We've got Sting. We've got Nickelback. We've got Tony Bennett, of course. We've got Lionel Richie for the first time. For the Stonewall 50th anniversary, which is 2019, we've got the wonderful jazz pianist Fred Hirsch coming for the Martin Theater. And we're bringing back Considering Matthew Shepard, the piece that was written to honor the murdered kid from Wyoming. The 20th anniversary of that murder was last year. We did the piece at Ravinia. We're bringing that back this summer because of the Stonewall anniversary. We're also bringing back Leonard Bernstein's Mass, which truly, Sharon, in my decades of working in this business, which I've loved every minute of, and I've been around great performances and great artists, I've been lucky. Nothing ever that I've ever touched has had the impact of this particular piece on audiences at Ravinia. With continual emails, phone calls, texts, I see people at other concerts. They tell me how great that performance was way back in July. So we're bringing that back as well with the same cast, same production. So many people heard such great things about both these pieces, Mass and Considering Matthew Shepard, but they missed them. So we thought, you know what? Let's bring them back. Why not? We love to be able to take care of our audiences and in whatever way we possibly can. We got lots of great kids shows. We've got great chamber music. We've got a commissioned piece from the late, great Andre Previn for Renee Fleming in the Martin Theater. On and on and on. So many terrific things. Kesha. We're doing the movie Coco with live orchestra, as well as Ghostbusters, On the Waterfront, and West Side Story. We've got Jennifer Hudson as our gala soloist. For the first time, she's singing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Lots of thrilling things.
That sounds like quite a list. You've been busy over the winter.
It's been busy, yeah. You know, but I'll tell you, it's because of the media. It's because of people like you, Sharon, getting the word out. When that happens, what happens is the agents and the artists hear it. And that's where you start getting buzz. That's where, you know, we didn't really have much of a country list, for instance, at Ravinia when I came. And it's music that I grew up with and I love. So the way that happens is you get somebody like Carrie Underwood to come, right? Then everybody takes notice. So this summer, we've got Lady Antebellum coming for the first time. We've been trying for them since their first hit record. And we've got Sugarland and Little Big Town coming. That's a viral thing that really the media helps out with in so many different ways. Common came a couple years ago. This year he's coming back with Queen Latifah. That's because of that first appearance that he had. Even though he's a Chicago guy, he's never played Ravinia. So that's how these things happen. And we're very grateful for all of our partners, such as yourself.
Thanks so much for that. And I really appreciate it. It's great how those things just kind of take on a momentum of their own.
They do. They do. It's like a, not an avalanche, that's a bad word, but it is sort of a snowball kind of effect where people start to take notice and then you start, and then, of course, once you get the artist, you get the audience, right? And that's the really exciting part, not just from a box office point of view, but to make sure that Ravinia really lives up to its mantra, which is something for everyone, right? All audiences, all ages, all backgrounds, all neighborhoods, everything.
That's really cool. And you got some other really cool new features at the park, a new rooftop club, and an immersive experience center?
We do. We do. And I would love to give you all the details about the new Experience Center, which we're calling the Ravinia Music Box. But actually, I'm just doing the show right now. I can tell you that it's going to be completely teched out. I can tell you that it's going to have a museum component, in which will be the 100th birthday museum exhibit that the Grammy Museum put together about Leonard Bernstein, which has already been in D.C. at the Kennedy Center, in New York at Lincoln Center, at the Skirball Museum in L.A. It's going to go to Vienna and Paris and London and to Chicago to come to Ravinia. So all summer, people will be able to celebrate and enjoy that.
Is there anything else that you wanted to mention that maybe I have not asked you about that's coming up?
Just that the pricing for all of our classical music continues to be the lowest in the country by far, especially for a great symphony orchestra like the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, but also our chamber music and recitals. We really do have something for everyone. We've got this. I'll leave you with this one because I'm excited about them. There's a group from Europe called Stile Antico. This is a group that does medieval and Renaissance vocal ensemble music. Sharon, they sing like angels. It's incredibly beautiful stuff. It may be something that people don't think they really want. It's too churchy. It's too religious. It's just beautiful. And in our stunning Martin Theater, that concert in June is going to be very, very special indeed.
That sounds really great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And thanks for the conversation as well.
Absolutely. Can't wait, Sharon. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update. I'm Tom Maloney, in for Dee Dotson. The team at the Cedar Lake Historical Association, led by Executive Director Julie Zazzata, found a way to keep interest in the town's history alive, even in the dead of winter. Julie talked about the museum that is open only 5 months a year and the museum roadshow stops with Chris Nolte this week on Regionally Speaking.
The museum is set up with a bunch of different vignette rooms. Basically, you can go in and out of these spaces and experience what our town founder's doctor's office would have looked like, Dr. King's office. Or you'll see an example of what the parlor and the dining room might have looked like when the Lassons were operating the resort hotel. So each of the rooms tells a different story aspect of the town history, and including ice harvesting, of course. And then you're able to go in and out of those rooms and have a guided tour or do a self-guided tour through the museum, and then also take in a lovely view in the lake. So we're open May through September, and we're open Thursdays through Sunday afternoons. Hopefully that's enough time to give people the opportunity to come out and, like I said, enjoy the lake, see the museum, that kind of thing. But what we had done a couple of years ago, we realized, you know, every year people come out, they visit with us, but then we're losing them over the winter. We don't really have any programs going on. There's no way to stay connected to them. And we have to rebuild our audience every single season. Mm-hmm. And we came up with this idea. We wrote for a grant application to fund it called the History Roadshow. And we decided we're taking the museum on the road. We're going to take it to different parts of the community. The first year, we just went to the library for five times in that winter, and we did a different program every month. And then this year, it was so successful that we did a second year. We're wrapping up our last program here in March. We decided to specifically focus on the history of Cedar Lake villages. It's a unique community in the sense that we don't have a downtown. So we have a lake that's in the middle of our town, but we have no downtown proper. And so what we did is we explored why that is. And we talked about all these different little villages that were populated around the lake and how they ultimately came to be the Cedar Lake that we know today.
When the folks came down, basically, I guess, during the summer months, when it was really nice and comfy down there along Cedar Lake, and people would take their vacations or weekends down there, and we're talking about people, I guess, that would come from miles and miles away, make literal trips and spend weekend and time off down there at the lake. How do they get together? The cottages, I know, that are that many people see that have kind of grown into now full-time residences along Cedar Lake, started out just as little places for people to stay. Is that how these villages got established over time?
In some regards, we had a lot of German settlers that came over, and so they were farmers. And so they set up these farming communities all around, all the way out to like Brunswick, which is out by Calumet Avenue out here, and things like that. So several miles off the lake in some cases, but around the lake, it was definitely a resort community. They would use the lake for, like I said, the ice harvesting industry. When the resort era hit, there was a lot of, ferrying people from the train. The Monon came through. And so all the passengers coming through on the train, whether they were coming up from Indy or down from Chicago, they needed a place to get off the boat and then, get off the train and then take the boat around the lake to the different resorts. We had over 50 resorts at the height of our era.
It was quite a popular place. I know that I remember that there were people that would come from as far as the north shores of Chicago.
Correct. To come down. Matter of fact, a lot of people from Chicago would spend their summers, their entire summers at the lake. Dad would stay in the city and work, come down on the weekends, but Mom and the kids spent the entire summer at the lake.
When you set up the idea of the pop-up museum, I guess is what you're calling it, if you would say you have them kind of getting close to the start of the regular season now, let me ask first, are there any more that are going to be happening before the museum opens officially in May?
Yeah, we have one more this month. It's on Sunday, March 24th. Mm-hmm. It'll be right across the parking lot from our museum building in the town hall. So maybe we'll take a little polar bear tour as well. Again, there's no heat in the building, but we might be able to sneak some people in and look around before we open for this season. So we have March 24th is our last program, and then the month of April will really be devoted to getting the building clean and ready for we open on the first Thursday in May.
Now, for folks that will want to look forward to the pop-up museum this next winter when the museum officially closes, what will they see? How did you set up the idea of the pop-up museum to begin with there?
Well, it was really spurred on the fact that we had applied for a grant from the Crown Point Community Foundation Women's Giving Circle. And so when we applied for that grant, we were asked, you know, to make a little video, do a little something that was unique and interesting. And so that's how this whole concept was born, was as an opportunity to let this group of women know that here's the exciting things that we're going to try and do and how we're going to take the museum out into the community. So like I said, it started as a grant project, and now it's just kind of taken on a life of its own, and we're brainstorming what we're going to be able to do for this next winter already, because, of course, the preparation starts long before the presentations even begin.
Is this an opportunity for the town of Cedar Lake, as well as the Historical Association, to not only promote the history of the community and of the area around Cedar Lake, but also to help promote the economic opportunities that are there too?
Absolutely. You know, we have three kind of mottos or guiding principles: education, recreation, and history. So, you know, you're going to be able to come and learn things, but you can also come and relax and enjoy a day at the lake, and hopefully the museum will be a stop along your path. Maybe you'll take a lake tour. Perhaps you're going to eat in one of our local restaurants. You can make a day out of it if you're heading down south to Cedar Lake. There's a lot to see and do.
Now, what kind of reaction have you gotten from people that have come by and taken advantage of the pop-up museums when you've had them set up?
My most favorite reaction would be them sharing their own stories. We've been in four different villages so far. We'll do the fifth one on March 24th. But every single time, new people come out because they have a connection somehow, right, to that village, and they're sharing with us their stories. One woman came with a whole stack of photographs from when her grandparents would come to the lake, and there was even family reunions featuring her as well. So she brought that whole stack of photographs to us and was sharing. And another gentleman, when we were in the Brunswick Schoolhouse, came out with a whole binder full of information and research that he's done on the local schools in our area, and was sharing all of his memories. So each site seems to bring out a different group of individuals and then new stories as well.